Who's there?
We'll bring to order the Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance Committee and begin with a roll call.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Becker Finn.
Here.
Representative Considine.
Here.
Representative Dean. Representative Frankie.
Here.
Representative Russell.
Here.
Representative Howe. Representative Lomer.
Here.
Representative Lucero.
Here.
Representative Neuberger. Representative O'Neill.
Here.
Representative Pinto. Representative Ward.
Here.
Representative Zerwas.
Okay. I'll entertain a motion to approve the minutes for March 1st.
So moved.
Representative Considine moves for approval of the minutes for March 1st. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion carried. We have House File 140, Representative Erickson. And the chair will move House File 140 to be referred to the Education Finance Committee. And Representative Erickson, go ahead and begin. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's a privilege to be in front of your committee. Mr. Chair, I have an amendment, the A18, that I think Representative O'Neill will offer for us to get this section that we're going over today in the order in which I'd like it.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the A18.
Okay, Representative O'Neill moves the A18 to get the bill in shape the author would like it. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Representative Erickson, to your amended bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, in the House File 140, which is the reform bill for governance and licensure for our teachers of this state or for those candidates or those coming from out of state to become licensed. And so in section on page 41, which is section 19, and on page 41 of the engrossment that you have, the reason I'm here is that we have added to this responsibility of this new board the fact that they must report to appropriate law enforcement authorities any revocations, suspensions, or agreements involving a loss of license relating to a teacher or administrator's inappropriate sexual conduct with a minor. And for purposes of this section, a law enforcement refers to police department, county sheriff, or tribal police department. And then with that additional amendment, it's just a cross-reference member so that we remind school boards that, or any person who's charged with mandatory reporting, such as the teachers are, that they follow through with Section 626.556, which is the Maltreatment of Minors Act that we have enacted. It is important that that we keep in mind that we sometimes have infractions occurring in our public schools. We had an incident several years ago, 20 years ago already, in which a teacher, a male teacher in one of our school districts, had an inappropriate relationship with a student during her junior and senior years. And it wasn't until 2000, and this started in 1987, members, it wasn't until 2000 that the school district received the allegations and the teacher resigned. If this provision had been in place then, there would have been the mandatory reporting that had to occur, because it was then in 2001 that the teacher signed a stipulation agreement with what we now call the Board of Teaching, confessing to the inappropriate relationship and agreeing to a revocation of his teaching license. But that license was active, members, during that time, and we can't have that occurring in our profession. So then, in November of 2010, the local sheriff's office became aware of the allegations. When the victim finally came forward, law enforcement got a copy of the signed stipulation after making a request for documents from the Board of Teaching. It came to our attention last year, and we called the Board of Teaching in to discuss this with us. And I think they believed that they were not a mandatory reporter because 3 years had expired since the revocation had been issued. So members, this is for clarity and to ensure that the Board of Teaching or this new creation, which we hope will be the Professional Educator Licensing and its Standards Board, as well as the Board of School Administrators, become mandatory reporters of any of these offenses that are committed to our children in our public school system. And that's it in a nutshell, Representative Cornish.
Okay, members, before questions, if we could confine our comments to the reason that the bill's here instead of going over the whole bill. That's what we usually do. However, we don't restrict people, but appreciate it if we could just stick to the portions that are our concern. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the author, you keep saying just to the public schools. What happens if it happens in a private school?
Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, the same would apply.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So why, when you discuss it, do you only say in the public schools?
Representative Erickson.
Well, the Professional Educator Licensing and Standards Board is specifically designed to license teachers, and I think the directive there is just to tell them they're mandatory reporting. So if there's a teacher, and so I'm probably misspeaking and speaking too broadly, but if a report comes to them and they act on it, they must, in this provision, report that revocation, whether that teacher's in the public sector or the private sector, to law enforcement. So I think maybe I was speaking too broadly when I said public, but we are intended here to create a licensure board that is under our purview. So I apologize if I made that sound too broadly.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mandating reporting has been the law for any number of professions for 20, 30 years.
Yes.
I'm not seeing what is different about this. It is covered. I mean, if you witness something, you have to report it, and then action has to be taken.
Representative Erickson?
Well, Representative Cornish and members and Representative Considine in particular, I don't believe that our present Board of Teaching has believed that after the three-year limit that they have had to be a mandatory reporter, and that's why law enforcement did not learn about this until they requested it.
Representative Considine.
They're wrong. Why don't we just fix what is there and or make that known to them rather than bringing in another entire law? I mean, it's, like I say, it's been there. It's, I think, reasonably clear. I was a mandated reporter. My wife's been a mandated reporter. If you don't do it, you can be charged.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Considine, I'm not sure if mandatory reporting applies directly to employees or appointed officials in the executive branch, and that's my concern. That's something you're going to have to deal with in the future. And I'm saying I'm not sure. And I think that's something that you should look into, which is why I've included it here. Because the Board of Teaching, these are board members appointed by the executive branch. So whether or not mandatory reporting actually refers to them, I'm not sure. I don't think there's anything that clearly states that.
Considine?
Maybe I'm not understanding what you're doing then. So this is directed,
at least in regard to the three-year window.
Okay. Is this specifically for school boards then?
Mr. Chair, this is the Board of Teaching, or this new board that we're trying to create, to ensure that if the three-year window does not apply to them, that it should apply to them, but that's a discussion you would have to have. In the meantime, we would like to declare in this proposal that they are mandatory reporters, regardless.
I believe they are. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay, members, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, whether they're mandatory reporters or not at this time, this language you have in here is for clarification to make sure that they do report.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm consulting with nonpartisan staff as well, but In Section 15, fraud and gross misdemeanor, that just recodifies, that is not changing that section in any fashion. I just want clarification on that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Beer. I probably should explain something about this House file. What the Legislative Audit Report indicated to us a year ago was that we really had a lot of statutes in the education code that dealt with teacher licensure or administrative licensure that were confusing, misplaced, out of order. And so what we did is we asked nonpartisan House research to reorganize the statute, and in that manner we placed this provision, this section to which Representative Hailstrom refers, in a different place. So you'll see the brackets around the numbers. That means it's not new language, it's a replacement, because we're reordering this part of the education code so that we think there's better understanding from those who need to refer to it when these issues are before them, whether it's licensure or it's renewal or it's the governance of teacher and administrative licensing.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bilster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, then, that's the same in Article 2, Section 7 on the background checks. That's all the same. No changes are made there either.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hailstrom, that's correct.
Okay. Members, questions? Any member of the public wish to testify? Seeing none, Representative O'Neill, would you like to renew your motion for the amended bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I renew my motion.
Representative O'Neill, the motion to move House File 140 as amended, re-referred to the Education Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
Thank you very
Mr.
much,
Chair.
Representative Erickson. Okay. Representative Rosenthal, House File 352. If you folks would like to move Representative Rosenthal's bill, Representative Hailstrom?
I'm sorry?
You want to move the bill, anybody over there?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, I will move the bill. Where would you like
Chair,
it to go?
I'll lay over.
Okay. I'll move the bill to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Okay, Representative Rosenthal, your bill has been moved and is before us. Go ahead however you would like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I have to say it's good to be back here. I've been on this committee every year until this year, so it's nice to be back in front of you. This bill tries to get out a problem we're having with drug testing in a timely manner. There's a lot of cases out there right now when cases go to trial and the drug testing has not arrived yet. So that's what this bill does, is try to cut down the time and turnaround time for the tests to be done. And, you know, I think it's a really important part of our judicial system to be timely and have the evidence available at trial. And I have a couple testifiers. I'd be glad to answer questions, and I'll turn it over to them.
Hey, your testifier, or your name and title, and go ahead, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. And members of the committee. My name is Andrew Lefever. That's L-E-F-E-V-O-U-R. I am a managing attorney at the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. I've been in the office for 23 years. I've been a prosecutor for 30 years. My duties presently is I oversee our community prosecution division, which I oversee the prosecution of our drug cases, our gang-related violent crimes, and our property offenses. And I'm here today with Crystal White from our office, who is the senior attorney who is the direct supervisor of our drug team. And what we came here today to discuss is a pilot project that we introduced approximately a year ago with the assistance in the partnership with the BCA to address some of the problems that we were experiencing in Hennepin County related to the timeliness of drug testing in relationship to criminal cases. So if I can give you a little background on our project, and then we'd be available for questions if needed. So the drug testing we're talking about here today relates to a criminal investigation where narcotics are seized. While a law enforcement officer does have that base of knowledge and experience to identify what they believe to be a controlled substance, we obviously have to have those that that potential narcotic tested and confirmed to be a controlled substance. So the role of the BCA then in this investigation would be that law enforcement officers would deliver the suspected narcotics to the BCA, and it's sent to their labs for testing. And what we were experiencing up through March of 2016, it was taking 4 to 6 months for testing to be completed on cases in Hennepin County. The result of that was the number of hearings that had to be set in district court were ranging between 5 to 6 appearances on a single drug case. What was happening is our bench figured out over time that if we had a trial date set, the BCA would accelerate testing on that issue, so they were setting cases for trial that we felt potentially would be cases that could be resolved if we had the testing. But in order to accelerate the testing process, we were having them to subpoena cases that potentially weren't cases that would have never gone to trial. They were cases that were likely to resolve. So this was creating a significant issue within our bench, how our standing with our bench in terms of getting discovery delivered in a timely manner, when the only thing delaying the process was drug testing that was lasting or being determined in 4 to 6 months from the date of the beginning of the testing. So what we did in Hennepin County, we did some research on this, and we discovered in several jurisdictions in the country there has been a new form of testing called microcrystal testing, which is an accelerated testing process of narcotics that has a very high rate of reliability, and based upon it's not sufficient in the sense of testing to have a confirmatory result that we would need to establish if the case were to proceed to trial. But at the threshold of an omnibus hearing where we can engage in a negotiation, microcrystal testing is trusted by the defense and the bench. So we did some research on this. We got our bench involved as well as our public defender's office in Hennepin County. Everyone was able to review the research and study the process and come to an agreement that we all had a level of confidence. Based upon that, the Hennepin County Board, using property tax funds in a partnership with the BCA, added 2 scientists as well as the equipment and microscopes necessary to support those scientists to introduce this pilot project to experiment and see if microcrystal testing would make a difference in how we process cases in Hennepin County. So the project started in March of 2016, and what has happened is in the case in Hennepin County, when we have a first appearance on a case we've charged, the first omnibus hearing will be set 4 weeks out. The microcrystal testing that we were able to roll out with the BCA gets us test results now within 2 weeks. So at the time of that first omnibus hearing now, the defense has all the information that they need to have an informed conversation with their client, and it leads to a productive omnibus hearing and a negotiation. So what we have found coming up on a year of stats, that we have obviously fewer trial settings. On average, we process 2,400 drug cases annually in Hennepin County. We've determined that we have, within this past year now, we've had 6,000 fewer appearances on drug cases, all based upon the help of the microcrystal testing. The fewer trial settings means that we're not subpoenaing chemists unnecessarily. Once a chemist at the BCA gets a subpoena, obviously that creates a commitment for them on their calendar, which would obviously pull them away. They have to leave that day open potentially for trial testimony. So the fact that we're not sending those unnecessary subpoenas to them gives them more time, obviously, to do their primary job of the testing. So it, in terms of the amount of court time, chemist time, and time our staff is in court has been reduced significantly. Um, What we've also found during this process, in the cases that have moved forward to trial, we've had no false positives in terms of the testing. There's a very high level of reliability in the microcrystal testing. The confidence is shared with our public defender's office as well as our bench. Everyone is on board with this project, and it's had great results. Our pilot has proven to be successful, and I would, in support of House Bill 352, we're asking that you extend that support to that to allow the BCA to explore the opportunity to continue to support Hennepin County with the microcrystal testing as well as explore if it's relevant to you statewide as well. Thank you.
Thank you, members. Representative Hilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have there been any FRIMAC hearings related to the science in your jurisdiction, and has the science been proven, or do you anticipate that at some point, if we expand it statewide, that there would be more contested omnibus hearings actually challenging the science as we see with other lab tests?
Mr. LaFever.
Chairman Cornish, Hilstrom, we did a lot of work on the front end with our public defender's office. They actually went out to a few of the jurisdictions, San Diego being one of them, that had been using microcrystal. So even before we engaged in the funding, we had agreement with them that they had confidence, and we have not had that FRIMAC test in Hennepin on microcrystal. I can't speak for what might happen statewide, but I would imagine if we did the groundwork of explaining it, giving them an opportunity, all the stakeholders an opportunity to understand what's going on with microcrystal, that that could be avoided. But you can never say that a defense attorney might not want to explore a FRIMAC hearing in terms of if they individually don't have confidence in the testing.
And ma'am, your name and title, and begin.
Crystal White, I'm a senior assistant Hennepin County, Mr. Chair, County Attorney. To piggyback on what Mr. LaFever said, we are using, to make it clear, microcrystal testing is a preliminary test that we're using to negotiate in good faith with members of the Public Defender's Office and the private defense bar that appears in Hennepin County has not challenged it yet. If a trial is set, which is happening significantly less than before we rolled this out, the drugs are going back to the BCA for confirmatory GCMS testing, which is the full testing that has always been done in drug tests and has had multiple FRIMAC hearings and is scientifically proven reliable. So what it's doing is on the front end, it's allowing us to negotiate cases earlier on in the process and send less cases onto the trial calendar. So we haven't, at this point, had a need for the FRIMAC hearing because of the coordination with the defense bar, and we're not using it at trial.
Hey, members, questions? Representative Franklin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rosenthal, I'm just looking here, and it's the basic gist of the bill says, timely chemical testing of controlled substance, evidence collected, crime scenes appropriation, and I'm hearing about a program of the microcrystal testing and studies. Is this just basically for an FTE, or are we looking at appropriating money for a possible statewide use? Could you just break it down on what exactly this appropriation would go for?
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Franke. The appropriation is left blank because we're working with the BCA right now to determine how many people and might be needed to make the turnaround a lot faster, like 2 weeks. So I don't have a direct number now, but it is for additional testing, and I believe it's for additional FTEs as well. But I can, the department here, the BCA is here, if they want to comment, you should ask them.
Representative Frankie, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'm just wondering, Representative Rosenthal, is this going to become a statewide standard, though? Is this the hope for us? It sounds like a good deal.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Frankie, the idea is to have it go statewide. The backlog is huge, and it makes sense that we can cut it to the fastest possible turnaround time is the intent of the bill. And we could, statewide makes sense to me.
Thank you, Representative.
Any other members? Representative Grossfeld and then Representative Johnson.
I guess the question would be for one of the folks over to the left of the representative. The fuel testing that takes place on scene, is that going to be taken out of the equation, or is that still going to be something that is based, you know, so officers can test the stuff on the scene, get a reading on it, and put that into their initial reports?
Mr. LaFever.
Thank you, Chairman Cordes. Representative Grossfeld. No, this would not have any impact on field testing. Field testing obviously is a tool to help an officer establish probable cause at the scene to continue investigation. This really has no role or supplanting that in any way. This is more a function of getting a preliminary test done in a timely manner so the attorneys that are prosecuting the cases can get those cases moving quicker, have a constructive negotiation with the defense in a timely manner to, you know, assist in court time, all staff time, and just create a little more efficiency in how we process cases. If we have a case charged and we really can't have a constructive conversation in resolving that case for 4 to 6 months, you're really losing some of the impact of how you might be an effective negotiation on that case. If it's someone that needs treatment, you want to get that resolved and get them into a treatment program within a few weeks if we can now, instead of waiting 4 to 6 months. Many of these cases, if they're low-level offenders, these defendants will be out on bail. So you'll be in a period where they're out on the streets for 4 to 6 months, not potentially getting the help or support they could get from a constructive negotiation that might result in some treatment or whatever support they might need to, if it's an addiction situation. So in many ways, it just creates greater efficiencies, and it's a more constructive process for us.
Okay, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I was wondering if Drew Evans would come down, since I saw him up there.
Superintendent, go ahead with your name and title and begin.
I am Drew Evans. I'm the superintendent of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension.
Mm-hmm. You had a question?
Mr. Chair, Superintendent Evans, we understand we've been dealing with this backlog since the mess with the St. Paul started up, and we've had to been dealing with that for a few years now. I'm just wondering, I know we added there's a couple more lab techs and scientists last biennium. Is the backlog, just wondering if the backlog is getting down, even though the number of cases are going up?
Superintendent.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, when it comes to the backlog, there's a whole number of factors that go into this with drugs. We have experienced a large number of drugs into our state in the last year. We've been experiencing over the last 4 to 5 years regular increases of 13% to 15% caseload increases into the laboratory for drug caseload. So our caseload right now is at a high level. We do have several scientists in training at the BCA. This process, and just for information for the committee, is that we do have a lot of promise for this process. Our scientists here, and we don't always like to come to this body to ask for more people and do the same thing we've always done. So this process was identified by our drug supervisor here, Glenn Langeberg, as he was out traveling around the country and brought this forward as a way to drive turnaround time down without simply adding more people to the process. It's worked very well in Hennepin County, but there is a tipping point, just to make this but I understand, and to Representative Hillstrom's question, the reason we haven't seen a FRIMAC hearing in all likelihood is that this is considered a very robust presumptive test, and before it goes to trial, we do go to confirmatory testing, meaning it goes through a gas chromatograph mass spectrometer, so we have a confirmatory test that has gone through FRIMAC hearings. And so it's a little bit of a long question. The backlog has been continuing to grow. It's currently at about 2,300 cases in-house currently, and we're at about a 100-day turnaround time, but we are working on a number of these processes, including this project with Hennepin County, and we have talked to a couple more counties to start rolling this out, but it, as they've noted, it really does require the buy-in of the defense bar and the bench to ensure that it's an effective process, and that's what we're working on currently.
before we begin, Representative Ward wanted to introduce some people. They have to leave pretty soon, so go ahead, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the back of the room is a group of students from one of the schools in my district, and I wondered if the committee would welcome them, please.
Give them a hand. Thanks for showing up and being here. Okay, Representative
Dunn, Mr. Chair, Superintendent Evans, so do you see this program involving where, in, if we could grow this type of program, where if we get these, not have as many court cases of people pleading out, it would actually reduce the backlog because these cases would not have to be tested?
Superintendent.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, that is our hope, and we've seen it work well in Hennepin County, and we're hopeful, and that's why we're rolling it out slowly so we can get out, and our laboratory and myself, we've been to meetings in these different counties to try to really roll it out the right way. So we have a lot of hope for it, but we're still evaluating the program.
Well, thank you.
Questions, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, what kind of dollar amount would it take to bring the backlog down? Do you have any analytics that you've done to see how much it would take and maybe have reduced it in half? Or I'm not sure exactly what this means as far as the acceptable range, so maybe you could give us more information on that.
Either one want to represent Roosevelt?
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, that's a great question. We're talking to the BCA and other organizations to come up with the right number. Right now, it's a blank appropriation, but we want to make sure that it's the right number and not just a guess. So we're going to continue to work on that, and as soon as we get you that information, we will.
Superintendent, you have something to add?
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, I mean, we are actively having those discussions. The really challenging part and what we're trying to work through is the interplay of this new testing process and not knowing if it'll be effective long term. So you're really having two different discussions as to if we don't use that process, what that number is, and if we do use that process. And that's what we're trying to work through with Representative and the other contestants.
Bless you. Okay. No more questions. Any testimony from the public? I see my BCA friend sitting up there. All right, if there's nothing, we'll move the bill, House File 352, to be held over for possible inclusion of work on that fiscal note. Thank you very much, Representative Rowe. Good to have you back here. You were a good member of our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. It's a pleasure to be back.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Grosso, House File 1481, and you could move your own bill once you get up there.
Hi, you people.
Representative Grosso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, representatives. I'm Representative Mac Russell for District 2A, and I'd like to introduce Elizabeth Ingham, RM. I move to have my bill laid over for inclusion for omnibus.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. Go ahead.
I'd like to introduce the two people to my left here, Elizabeth Ingham, who is an RM, and Peggy Hoff, an RN retired, and they'll be giving testimony today. I want to introduce HF 1481, enhanced criminal penalties for assaulting firefighters or medical personnel. This bill amends Section 609.2231, which criminalizes assaults on firefighters and emergency medical personnel. This bill makes the following changes to the statute. It expands the class of protected persons to include all medical providers who work in a hospital. The current law applies only to medical providers who work in a hospital emergency room. It creates a gross misdemeanor penalty for a physical assault on a firefighter or a medical provider who works in a hospital where the assault does not cause demonstrable bodily harm. The current law applies only when there is demonstrable bodily harm. And three, it creates a felony offense punishable by up to 3 years in prison and a fine of $6,000 for intentionally throwing or transferring bodily fluids or feces to a firefighter or medical provider who works in a hospital. That increases the maximum period of imprisonment for assaulting a firefighter or a medical provider who works in a hospital when the assault causes a demonstrable bodily harm from 2 years to 3 years, and in cases, the maximum fine from $4,000 to $6,000. I just want to give you a little bit of information here as well. Healthcare workers are at high risk for workplace violence with very little retribution for those inflicting the violence. The highest number of assaults in the workplace in the U.S. are towards healthcare workers. 24,000 workplace assaults occur each year, with 75% of those being in the healthcare workplace. And that's from Phillips of 2016. It's Phillips JP, Workplace Violence Against Healthcare Workers, the New England Journal of Medicine. Second thing is, according to the American Nurses Association, 2016, healthcare workers who leave their jobs as a result of workplace violence can contribute to their shortages of nurses. And that's from the American Nurses Association, Model State Bill, Violence Prevention in Healthcare Facilities. As one who has worked in law enforcement and emergency services, and one who has had to bring violent people to the ER or to the hospital for treatment, it was oftentimes because I worked in a small county, I was the only one on duty, and I would get called away, but I would have to leave that individual there. And knowing full well that, you know, that I just had to fight with this person to take him into custody and to subdue him and to then to take him, arrest him. And now I've got to leave them with medical personnel who are not trained the way I am, who are, you know, not equipped to handle those types of persons. So it was always something that, in the back of my mind, I didn't like to do, but because I got called away to another call, that's what I had to do. And then Ms. Engham here, approached me after I got elected and asked if I would do some research on seeing if there was something we could do to give more protection to hospital personnel and firefighters. So I will now, I guess I will turn it over to my two speakers here.
Okay, ma'am, introduce yourself and begin.
Mr. Chairperson and representatives, my name is Liz Engham. I am an RN at Sanford Bemidji Medical Center and work in the intensive care unit. In 2006, I took an oath, the same oath that all nurses take, to devote themselves to the welfare of those committed to their care. Every day, I and fellow nurses are placed in situations that may become violent. An example of this situation is that of which a patient that we were taking care of on the unit, she was there with an overdose in alcohol. She became aggressive and verbalized the intent to cause harm to a coworker. She proceeded to grab the coworker's arm, pull her arm, and tear her rotator cuff. The result of this action was multiple surgeries for the coworker, a great deal of pain, a year away from direct patient care, and the permanent loss of freedom of movement of her affected arm. I myself have been involved in or witnessed patients spitting on, hitting, scratching, or kicking nurses. These actions were committed by patients who had verbalized or appeared to have the intent to cause harm. In states such as Florida, acts of violence such as this hold the same penalties as those if they were committed against a law enforcement officer. I feel that if there was increased penalties and public awareness, it would force patients to reconsider their behaviors. This, in turn, would cause a safer work environment for nurses throughout the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Ma'am, introduce yourself, name and title, begin, please.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Peggy Haft. I'm an RN retired from Abbott Northwestern Hospital. While working one evening in the intensive care unit, I walked into a patient's room when I noticed he was getting out of bed despite being hooked up to various IV catheters. I remember saying, no, no, go back. But before I could reach his bedside, he lunged at me and had me by the neck. He pushed me across the room. When I looked up, I saw his fist ready to strike me. I remember thinking to myself, I would rather get hit in the back of the head than in the face, so I turned away. A sound in the hallway distracted him, and soon several other staff members were in the patient's room. In my 30-year nursing career in the ICU, I experienced violence toward me numerous times, none of which should be considered part of my job. But this time was different. No patient had ever so deliberately and violently assaulted me. As I was being treated for my injuries in the emergency room, the nurses caring for me asked if I wanted to contact the police. I did, and I spoke with the Minneapolis police officer that evening in the emergency department. Several days later, after filing that report, I contacted the Minneapolis police. I was told that because the assault occurred in the intensive care unit as opposed to the emergency department, the penalty for the crime was lower. The officer told me I could press charges, but it would be difficult to obtain a judgment. I decided there wasn't really much point in pursuing the case. At the time and now, too, it doesn't make sense to me that the same crime committed in an outpatient setting, such as the emergency department, would carry greater consequences than when committed in the intensive care unit. I'd like to finish with some information and a quote from Mary Turner, who is the president of MNA, the Minnesota Nurses Association. Healthcare workers are assaulted every day. They are hit, punched, kicked, pinched, and verbally assaulted so often that some just accept it as part of the job. Nurses of the Minnesota Nurses Association feel strongly that violence is no part of that job. We hope this effort by Representative Matt Grasso will create a safe environment for patients to heal and effectively address the rare instances when an aggressive person should be charged with assault. We trust Representative Grasso knows what it's like as a police officer, and he's related that, to bring a patient to the emergency room in handcuffs and then leave them for nurses and others to treat. I thank him for standing up to take on this issue. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to tell my story, one that's all too common.
Okay, Representative.
Mr. Chair.
Constable Dine and Representative Ward. Yeah.
Have one more person to testify, if I could. From the firefighters?
Yeah. Well, sir, is your name and title and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kirk Peterson. I'm with the firm of Rice, Michaels, and Walther. We represent the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. It's a group of about 1,600 full-time professional firefighters that represent about 43 communities throughout the state. We also support this bill. Appreciate the representative bringing it forward. The nurses did a really good job of telling the examples of what we have to go through. In many communities, the firefighters are the first responders on medical calls. Often the fire departments get there before the ambulances, and we end up transporting or assisting with transporting people back to emergency rooms and end up staying with them in the hospitals. And we go through a lot of the same thing that the nurses go through. So I don't have a lot to add other than that unless anybody has any questions, but wanted you to know that we do support this bill.
Okay, thank you, sir. Now, questions, Representative Considine, Ward, and Pinto.
I don't have a question, Mr. Chair. Well, actually, I do at the end. happy to be a co-author on here. I think we should be extending the same protections that we have extended to corrections officers and the police. Actually, my question, though, is, isn't this Representative Garofalo's first bill in front of this committee, and didn't he forget a tradition?
Representative Garofalo.
Yeah, where's our cookie?
Yeah.
Actually, it's the second bill.
First one was yesterday.
Oh, first one
was yesterday. Who doesn't cookies? Boy, I wouldn't get any cookies out either.
I'll make it up to you.
All right.
We'll hold you to that.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I too support the idea of anything that we can do to keep people safer. I do question how we can do that, though, and is punishment going to be the right thing when we're talking about people who are out of control of themselves? They're not thinking rationally anyway, and I don't think they're going to be swayed by punishment. My son is an ER doctor, and I have a daughter-in-law who's an ER nurse. And before that, Chris was a paramedic, so he's done these kinds of things and been in those positions. And I have a great deal of sympathy and concern for all of the medical personnel and the firefighters. You know, my instinct says we've got to do something about the violence in our society so that people aren't put in these positions in the first place. But I particularly wonder if there isn't something else that we could do to ensure safety in those places so that you don't have to leave. Or that, you know, is there some way that we can provide backup to you so you don't have to leave people in vulnerable situations?
Representative Raffel, short answer if you could. We've got two more questions and two more bills. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. And I trust the professionalism of the nurses, the doctors, the paramedics, the firefighters, and law enforcement. And as far as making that discretionary call as to what occurred, you know, it's not going to be a free-for-all as far as charging people that are not in the right state of mind, that are not in control of their mental functions at that time. And then, again, I trust our county attorneys and our judges to look at those situations as well. So it's a matter of taking care of the people who are trying to take care of us. That's what I want to do with this. But, again, I trust their judgment and their discretion as to what is an intentional and violent attack against them.
Okay, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the testifiers, Representative Grassley. I support the bill. I'm a co-author on it. But I was thinking about just one issue in the one point thirteen and one point fourteen about removing the reference to emergency department. What I'm thinking is that there's a lot of physicians and nurses that are working in other medical settings, and I'm just trying to think. Again, I haven't like landed on this, but I'm just thinking that once we take away the limitation of an emergency department, now hospitals providing care in all sorts of other settings that look a lot like other medical clinics, and now suddenly are we kind of saying that in any medical setting, which we're not here, but I'm just trying to understand what the distinction might be, wondering if either you or the testifiers can help me think that through, because I feel like an emergency department's one thing that makes sense. It looks a lot like a secure treatment facility or correction employee, some of the other things we have under 609.2231. But once we start extending to other parts of the hospital, people coming in for other kinds of care, then it starts looking like those other clinics. And I'm trying to think of what the distinction is.
And Representative Raffel.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. There have been incidents that have been, for example, in the ICU, someone who has been there and is being treated and then attacks someone. So it's a matter of, you know, to cover those people while they're in their duties. There have been incidents where people have been assaulted in waiting room areas or when they're coming in. You know, so it's, again, it's to help cover the personnel that we have in vulnerable situations. They don't have somebody to watch their back all the time. Firefighters don't have somebody to watch their backs. Nurses don't have someone to watch their backs. So it's a matter of covering as many people as we can to give them the blanket so that they can work and they can take care of the people and if something should happen, that there is some recourse for them.
And Mr. Chair, I guess I'm just trying to, I'm thinking that though the same sort of things are true in waiting rooms and other medical facilities. You know, somebody might have some kind of outpatient treatment at a hospital, might end up going to a smaller clinic that's not a hospital. I'm just trying to understand the distinction there of you know, why we wouldn't be then covering all medical personnel, which I'm not advocating for. I mean, then I start getting worried that now it's just looking like all sorts of professions could get covered. I'm just trying to understand why the draw the line. We may not solve this here, but I guess this is just something that I'm still kind of struggling with.
It's something that we can work on.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dean.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we might have already, spoke to the question I was going to raise around county attorneys and judges taking into consideration those individuals who might be in a hospital, say on a psych unit or a locked unit or something like that, which I think the care providers in that unit understand that, you know, they might be a little bit greater risk, but at the same time, a person's mental state at the time would have to, I'm assuming, play into how a county attorney or a judge might consider these types of enhancements to penalties.
Okay. Any questions for members? Any public testimony? Oh, question. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the interest of time, I'll be brief. Representative Grassl, thank you for bringing this forward on behalf of all of the folks of the emergency medical community and for all of the folks that have co-authored this. I have had partners who've had their teeth knocked out. I have had partners who, female partners and male partners, who have been assaulted in the back of the ambulances with patients. They had no clue. They never saw it coming. In one instance, they stopped the ambulance because the assault was in progress. The patient, who is now the committing this assault, jumped out the back door and ran off down the freeway. Thankfully, the assault stopped at that time. On the flip side of that, I have another partner where the exact same thing happened to him. When they stopped the ambulance, the assailant jumped out of the back of the ambulance, ran away, saw that the police weren't there, turned around, came back, and continued the assault. Myself, I've had patients look me right in the eye and say, I have tuberculosis, and spit in my face. And of all of these cases, I can tell you that nothing happened. So thank you on behalf of all of these medical providers, whether they're in a hospital, or whether they're in an ambulance, or they're a firefighter, thank you for doing that. And just briefly to Representative Pinto, to your comments, I think what we're looking for is perfect, and perfect doesn't exist. This is really good, and I'm okay with really good. And I think that if you look into the number of occurrences of these assaults that happen, the overwhelming majority of them are either on the street or in a hospital. I don't think that the numbers pan out in the clinics. Would I like this to expand the clinics? Sure, I would. But right now, that's in the scope of what we're trying to do here. We're going to settle for really good. I don't know if we can get to perfect, but I'll take really good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, a representative from NAMI here. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. We are holding from NAMI, Minnesota. I just want to just raise a concern, and that is, again, for people who are in a psychiatric unit, also someone who has serious dementia, someone with a serious and more profound autism who might be actually tactically defensive. So if someone touches them, they might, you know, just automatically do that. And the word intentional is only on line 1.19 and not 1.18. And the standard for being, you know, being not guilty by reason of mental illness is actually really high, which is higher than, you know, really trying to assess whether someone really was intentionally. I can understand when someone's threatening, you know, to do that, and they do that. But I just want us to be cautious. We don't want to keep putting more people with mental illness, you know, in jails and in prison when they're in a crisis state when they get to the hospital. Thank you.
Okay, members. Anyone else from the public? Just a real quick one here. We always worry about these, whether the deterrents are actually working or not. But NAMI, I don't think, was too excited about a bill I had where we were charging mentally ill and dangerous in St. Peter. But we were having a problem with continued assaults in St. Peter's, Representative Considine, I know. But we upped the penalty because the county attorney said it was hardly worth charging anybody go up against a Rule 20 hearing for such a low offense. So we upped the penalty. The county attorney started charging, And I called, I had a couple of calls from people out at the St. Peter Hospital said that it seemed to be working as a deterrent. The assaults have come down. So I believe that deterrence can work sometimes, but we don't want to naturally throw everybody in jail. But the county attorneys can always be a filter and help make that decision of what was intentional and what was an abhorrent act. Any other questions from members or public testimony? Seeing none, Representative, Representative Grossel, you can move your own bill to be laid over.
I move it, sir.
Okay, Representative Grossel's bill, House File 1481, will be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Grossel.
Thank you.
And Representative O'Neill has House File 1252 with the same destination in mind, I believe. Representative O'Neill, would you move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 1252 to be laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill.
Okay, Representative O'Neill, begin however you would like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So this afternoon, almost this afternoon, this morning still, I have a wonderful bill, and I'm very excited to bring it forward. It's a great collaboration between the public and private, and it leverages pro bono lawyers that want to come and help children that are in need, children that have experienced trauma, children that are being taken out of their home who don't have representation from a lawyer. And we have a great opportunity here to expand this program, and I'm going to turn it over to the executive director to tell you what we've done. But before I do that, let me just explain quickly what the bill does. This bill appropriates $350,000 in fiscal year 18, specifically to the Commissioner of Public Safety for a grant to organizations that provide legal representation to children in need of protection and children in out-of-home placement. The funding will be a part of the OJP base appropriation, and there is $150,000 in the base each year already, specifically for this program, but this would be an expansion. And I'll turn it over to the executive director to have her tell you about the great work that we've done, that they have done, but I say we because we, the state, have now collaborated with them. Very excited to have her here this morning.
Thank you.
Director, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, my name is Lilia Pantileva. I am the executive director of Children's Law Center, and we are a private nonprofit organization that provides legal representation to children who are 10 years of age or older who are subject of a child protection petition. We leverage and utilize the work and amazing interest of our legal community to do this on a pro bono basis. In fact, we have approximately 300 active volunteer attorneys that are working our cases. We represent upwards of 700 children a year, and this is full legal representation, so this is for the entire case. We are generally a small organization, even though we leverage the time and expertise of our volunteer attorneys who are high-powered attorneys, of course, but don't necessarily or initially know much about the juvenile law. We recruit them, we train them, we support them, we provide them with the necessary resources, we attend court with them, we answer all of their questions to make sure that these kids receive the highest possible quality legal representation and that their voices are heard. With that said, even though all of that work is pro bono, it takes a lot of our time and a solid infrastructure to administer this volunteer attorney program. Our budget is approximately $700,000 annually, which I'm amazed how we do this work on this tiny budget. But our auditors are saying that if our volunteer attorneys were to bill for their services, it would cost the state approximately $3 million, if not more. I can tell you that we are very, very grateful for the grant that we received last year. It got us out of crisis. We had lost previously a grant from the Legal Services Advisory Committee, and the reason for that loss is because what we do really is the responsibility of the state. The statute, there is a statute in Minnesota that allows for a right to legal representation for children who are in foster care. We essentially provide those services with the leverage of volunteer attorneys on a very small budget. So while we're grateful for $150,000, we asked for $500 last year. I'm back to ask for more, and I respectfully request your consideration for that funding. Happy to answer any questions.
questions. Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Neill, for bringing this issue forward. I've previously aware of this issue and just really wanted to highlight what you just talked about, that unlike other nonprofits or organizations that are asking for funds, this is representation that is a right of the children who are getting this representation. It is already in state law that they should be getting this representation. So quick, hopefully an easy question. I really want to make sure that you get these funds to do the important work that you do. Is it going to be difficult to get to the contingent match? I don't want anything to slow down the ability to do this work.
Mr. Chair.
Director.
It will not. We raise approximately $400,000 ourselves, sometimes five, and the volunteer time is, you know, up north of $3 million, so we would not. That is essentially what we do. The amazing interest of our legal community to do this work would be silly for us to say to turn them down, because there is a lot of interest. They knock on our doors and say, you know, we would like to volunteer with you and do this work. Oftentimes they tell us that this is the most rewarding work they do with their legal license. It's an amazing commitment. Thank you.
Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative O'Neill, for this bill. And I just have a question. I guess I'm thinking about, it sounds like a great program and wonderful for children, but the guardian ad litem, I'm trying to differentiate between the two programs because I thought they did something similar. So could you just sort of help me understand?
Thank you. Director.
Guardian ad litems and attorneys for children have two separate roles. In the statute, the guardian ad litems are to represent what they believe is in the child's best interest. In the statute, it also says that they should not act as the child's attorney. What we do is we represent the child's expressed interest, expressed wishes, exactly what the child wants, their position. We advocate for their rights, and frankly, we hold the counties accountable for the services that they should be providing these children with. So two separate roles. Sometimes we're on the same page, sometimes we're not, but that's okay because we give the child a voice in the courtroom.
Okay. Any other members' questions? Seeing none, any testimony from the public? Representative O'Neill, any last comments before you lay your bill over?
Well, I just really hope that we can expand this just a little bit. It's really just an amazing partnership, and I think about some of the stories that the executive director had told me about children and, you know, coming out of trauma and coming out of a terrible situation and who's there for them. You know, they're just, sometimes there isn't anybody there for them, but this lawyer who actually, it's amazing because they are from the public or the private sector and they have such a passion for these kids and they've actually kind of stepped them through the whole process the whole way. And so it's just an amazing program, and I just hope that we can expand it.
Thank you. Director, I forgot to ask one question. What was the amount of the grant that you lost?
Mr. Chair, it was $48,000 to $52,000.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And with that, we'll lay over House File 1252 for possible inclusion in the bill. Thank you very much, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you.
Representative Zerwas, House File 839 with the same destination.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll move House File 839 be held over for possible inclusion.
And do you want to
in the omnibus bill? And I'll offer the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape which we'd like to discuss today. I'll move the A1, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Zerwas has moved his bill and moved the A1 amendment to House File 839 to get it in the shape you'd like. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, to your amended bill, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 839, as amended, is a bill to address some instances of people in the community either by dressing as or driving in vehicles that resemble police cars, people trying to impersonate either police officers or there's also a section in the bill that addresses people that are trying to identify themselves as security officers or people that have passed the private detective board licensing program. And I didn't realize there was still an issue with people impersonating police officers as vagrantly and flagrantly and publicly as there were. I mean, I think we all hear once in a while about someone putting a red light or a blue light in a squad car and trying to do something stupid along the roadway. But I think more recently we've had instances where we had an individual that dressed up to try to identify himself as a police officer and tried to insert himself into the Barway Collins case and search for that missing child. While dressed up to resemble a police officer, the individual gave statements to the press, gave interviews in which many people thought that he was representing law enforcement or speaking on behalf of law enforcement. He used phrases talking about the fluidity of the investigation and ongoing leads while leading people to believe that he was a police officer. And in fact, members of the media put him on TV to talk about the case. And so clearly this is still an issue. House File 839 increases criminal penalties and then further defines what's allowed on a security type uniform and what is not, and then what is allowed on vehicles that might be used by a security company versus what can be used in vehicles that are being used by a law enforcement agency. We have two chiefs here today, Chief Long and Chief Potts, that can offer testimony and help answer questions. With that, Mr. Chair, I will turn it over to my testifiers.
Okay, whichever chief would like to begin, introduce yourself and your city and begin.
Good morning, Chair and representatives. My name is Jeff Long. I'm Chief of Police in the City of Lakeville. I've been a police officer for close to 30 years and have seen incidents impersonating a police officer many, many times, but I'm going to just focus on one tonight that we have been doing this morning that we've been dealing with since 1912. It started with an individual that wasn't registering his car but had tinted materials over his license plate so you couldn't see it. His car was fully decked out with green lights, which is permitted by statute because it doesn't fit the red, amber, or blue lights. But yet he had a cage blocking the front from the back. He had a radar unit. He had a computer. He had a gun belt. All the things that you would suspect of a police officer, he had. Now, he had not done anything wrong that day except not registered his vehicle, and that was our first contact with him in 2012. Later in 2012, we had somebody report that they had contact with one of our police officers who was extremely rude, yelling and screaming at this person through their window at a stop sign or stoplight. As it turns out, they came to complain, and it wasn't one of our police officers. The person stayed quiet for a while, but resurfaced in 2015 when he stopped an individual in a Starbucks parking lot. A woman was in her car waiting for her fiancé to come out. He was closing up the business, and the impersonator picked it up a notch this time and actually ID'd, went up and asked for the person's driver's license representing him, representing himself as a police officer. She gave him the ID. He wrote down the information, went back to his car, and it was about a half hour later she became suspicious that something wasn't right because he was just sitting in his car staring at her. As it turns out, she called 911 because of the suspicions. We arrived, and it was the same individual we had been dealing with. In 2016, we went to a car accident that had been reported, and there, these prior incidents were Crown Victoria, similar to most police cars. In 2016, he was now driving a Dodge Charger, which is similar to many police cars. But this one was even more decked out. It had more lights than even squad cars have. He again had the blocker from the front to the back, the spotlight, all the regular things you'd see in a police car, but this time he was carrying a badge. The badge had some initials on it, FRA. We asked him what that meant, and he said it's a fugitive recovery agent. Nonetheless, he was cited once again for impersonating a police officer and having lights on his car that didn't match state statute. Again, this is just one incident that has been going on for 4 years. He recently posted a YouTube video in which he's selling off his equipment and says he's retiring from law enforcement. We hope that's true.
Thank you, Chief. Go ahead, sir, your name and title.
Mr. Chair, my name is Jeff Potts, the police chief in Bloomington. I'm representing the Minnesota Chiefs Association here today on this particular bill. Just to real quickly highlight just a slightly different type of situation than the situation that Chief Long just described, also was referenced by Representative Zerwas. You may have received the letter in your materials from Chief Revering from the Crystal Police Department kind of discussing what occurred during the Barway Collins investigation. In this particular case, an individual, whether it be by the uniform he was wearing or the car he was driving, misled many people in his efforts on the Barway Collins case. In that particular case, he injected himself into it and was, as mentioned, interviewed and did certain things during the search portion of this while it was still classified as a missing person investigation. And as it transitioned to a murder investigation, continued, whether it was intentional or not, I guess we don't know for sure, but confused the public about what his actions and what his responsibilities were. And in many cases, law enforcement is trying to build trust in our communities, in some cases maybe restore trust. And in this particular case, this individual was not a member of the police, the law enforcement agency working on the case, and did some things and said some things that, like I mentioned, misled the community, misled the law enforcement personnel working on it, and that's just simply not helpful in our efforts to build trust. And so this House File 839 attempts to kind of clean up some of those things and make it a little bit more clear, both by the uniform that individuals wear and the vehicles that they drive, who is and who isn't actually part of law enforcement. And really, that's what we're trying to accomplish with this bill.
Okay. Excuse me for not knowing your bill better, but is there anything in here to address the vehicles that the cops turn in when they're done with them, the black and whites, as far as being resold? I know there's always been a problem. In fact, I think it was last year, I was driving down the highway, and a guy with tinted windows in a black and white pulled up behind me, and they had on the license plate police instead of police written backwards, and it was actually a real plate. I asked to check it out, and I never did find out who it belonged to because they can't divulge that, but I found out it was a real plate. And most people look at it, and it says police behind you. They might think that the F is a P, but it might be obliterated and made it look like, and of course, I wasn't speeding anyway, but it did cause me to really take a second look. Is there anything about that you folks have talked about before in this bill about when you turn a car in to get new cars that the black and white has to be all one color, anything done to it to address that? Do they have to take the star off or the badge? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, there is not anything in this bill that deals with law enforcement agencies as they sell back vehicles. Subdivision 3 of the bill deals with security card vehicles. Says that they shall be predominantly gray. Both front door panels and the rear of the vehicle shall be identified as security. The identity must include the word security with the letters not less than 2.5 inches high and 1 inch wide of a 3/8 inch brush stroke. So I guess pretty specific. The identity shall be a color contrasting with the background. The identity may be in the form of an emblem. Each vehicle must be marked with its own identifying number on the rear of the vehicle. And so it deals with issues like that and transitioning that moving forward from 2018 that all vehicles to be used by licensed security officers or companies need to be predominantly gray, which would also, again, help differentiate them from law enforcement vehicles in Minnesota.
My problem would probably be hard to take care of because there would be a fiscal note on it. I mean, some large police departments turn in a whole fleet of vehicles to trade in, and to paint them all the same color, take spotlights off, and all the other things would probably be quite a cost that wouldn't be accounted for. So,
thank you,
just a real quick comment, Mr. Chair. It might be taking care of itself kind of on its own, that the majority of the manufacturers now are not delivering cars that actually paint the doors white. They have a wrap on them. And so, for example, in Bloomington, when we sell those cars, we remove the wrap, and it's sold as a black vehicle. It actually does help with the resale value as well. So I think many of the manufacturers are transitioning from those doors actually being painted, but rather having a wrap material on there, and it can be removed prior to sale. But currently there's no requirement for that.
Well, thank you for the bill, Representative Ross. It has been a problem in the past in Mankato. I know they get these SUVs, and they'll put the extra antennas, brush guard, lights. I mean, just the signature that it puts out is just like a squad car. We got a number of questions, Representative, about four of us. Representative Johnson's first.
Mr. Chair, Chief Long, that vehicle is still out there. It's just moved locations. I ran across it about a month ago on Highway 65 up in Isani County.
That's good to know. Thank you. We have put out a message to the metro area to keep an eye out for this car because of our concern that it's escalating. So thank you.
But I was going to say, Representative Zerwas, I like line 3.9, where it's a person can't own these vehicles anymore if they're marked that way. It has to be basically a business that has to own them. I think that's a good catch.
Yep.
Okay, Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm following up on what you were saying. I believe maybe we need to address this, because if you go to the Cubs parking lot in Mankato, there's a car there, all maroon, has a cage, has bumpers, has the spotlights still on it. I did call and talk to Chief Deputy Maurer about that, but I still see it on. It's just somebody that works at Cubs, and it looks like a squad car.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author, Representative Zerwas. So in our packet, we have an A1 amendment. Is it your intention to introduce that and add this to this bill or not?
Mr. Chair, I think we already added the A1. I think we did it right at the beginning.
We did?
Yeah.
Okay.
The A1 amendment, Mr. Chair and members, there's a section in the original language that talks about issuing an ID card out to everybody through the post board. Logistically, that was going to be a challenge, and so that was removed as a part of the A1. And then I think one of the dates, I think with vehicles, was pushed back to 2018 instead of 2017. I think that's the gist of the A1 that we adopted.
Mr. Chairman, I think that was related to uniforms, not to...
Oh, the uniforms, okay.
Yeah.
That could be.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Number, yes, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I believe you had a bill to deal with the issue of the ownership of vehicles previously that maybe we should revisit, because I do see still many of those black and white cars with the spotlights still on them. And if we are the ones that are selling them, the government are the ones that are selling them and putting them out there, and then we create a statute that says you can't own them and operate them, we just need to make certain we're consistent.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, Representative Hillstrom, you know, to be really clear, 3.11 deals with, or 3.10 through 3.17 deal with really specifically what you can't have. And it's, you can't have a motor vehicle marked or identified in any manner such as the word or words police, patrolman, sheriff, deputy, trooper, state patrol, conservation officer, agent, marshal, with any lettering, marking, or insignia or colorable imitation thereof, including but not limited to stars, badges, or shields identifying the vehicle as a federal, state, or county, or municipal law enforcement vehicle, you know. So I think that we're very specifically saying, and those markings I think it's practice of all law enforcement agencies to remove those markings prior to resale. But this is looking at people that want to quote-unquote be bounty hunters. And they're putting Marshall on the side of their car, and they're putting a cage in the back, and they're putting a few lights on, and they've got season 1 through 6 of Dog the Bounty Hunter on DVD playing next to them. That's what this is about.
I think what Representative Hilster was talking about, too, is like similar to what I said, the ones that don't take it off. You know, the biggest one that derailed my bill was the colleges, their security. The college government liaison come up to me and said, oh, that's going to cost us a terrible amount of money to paint the car all one color and make it look like it isn't a squad car. So, you know, seems like there's a fiscal note and everything to do. Representative Johnson, last question. And
Mr. Chair, Representative Zuwas, I just thought of one issue that you might want to try to clarify. We do have a lot of people that have old collector squad cars, and we need to clarify that in this bill, if you could work on that.
Mr. Chair, members will continue to work on that.
Okay. Public testimony. Seeing none. Representative Zerwas, any closing comments before you move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. It's a good bill. It increases criminal penalties on people that are doing stupid things.
Okay, thank you very much. And the bill will be laid over for possible inclusion. Members, this is just kind of a housekeeping item. When you have your bills like this, if you could separate the green from the white, it just helps out the pages. When they go to collecting, makes it quicker in case there's a committee behind or something, or if they're in a hurry to get the lunch. All right, with that meeting adjourned.